This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
As promised, I've got Dalian Mpofu in studio, and he's sitting here, and he's brought a book, he's brought a page, he's brought his glasses, he's in the regalia, and Dalian Mpofu is sitting here. We're going to be talking about a few things. I want to bump off quite a few things around him, but of course that is Dalian Mpofu. He's multifaceted, and you've seen him on your screens, and you would have seen him in the Red Berets, and you would have seen him as a family man, and you would have seen him in various other positions as well. Dalian Mpofu, welcome to Power 98.7. You're not a stranger.
Always a pleasure, Denzel. Good evening to you and to your listeners, of course.
Absolutely. So let me start off with something that's related, because you're a family person. No sebenzile.
Yes.
Not gile.
No.
Okay, then it's wrong in
the internet.
it's wrong. Dalian Mpofu. So no sebenzile then. Is your mom?
Yes, was.
Was your mom. Yes, just as was my mom. Yeah. When you reflect on her and you reflect on where you are today as a country and in this country, how would she be looking at you? How would she look at her son, Dalian Mpofu, today? What do you think?
Well, Denzel, fortunately, she only passed away a few years ago. And at my house, as it happened, which is not very far from here. So, yeah, it was quite a big moment. But, you know, now that, the years have rolled by, I'm still convinced that she was probably the most formidable force I've ever met. You know, a person who really had maybe 2 or 3 years of schooling, but easily the most intelligent person I've ever met, yeah. And a big influence, very strong person, and really nurtured the family and created all of us to what we are today.
Almost, matriarch.
Yeah, matriarch, but one with determination, you know, to make sure that you get a bit of education. But strangely, you know, when I think about it now in retrospect, you know, with the kind of determination she had, for example, for us to get an education, she probably would have been inclined to discourage, for example, my student activism, which started very, very early.
Yeah.
But never did, not once. You know, if anything, supportive. And I think that gave me a lot of courage. I mean, she had the displeasure of seeing us when we were, I think we were 17 or so, in a room where we had, you know, there were about 5 or 6 of us who had been literally tortured and beaten up. And just, you know, they had called our parents to give clothes or whatever. And just by chance, she managed to have a look into that room. Yeah. And I was telling one of my comrades, who's a woman, who was thoroughly beaten up there, that what my mother said, that when she looked into that room, it reminded her of the casualty ward in a hospital.
Wow.
So for a parent that has gone through all that, she really was she was a superstar. And
let me ask you this.
And we were very close because I was his only son.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, Dali. What do you think was the characteristic that didn't make you fall between the cracks? What was it that she engaged in, endured at, that made you continue a journey? What was it that...
That's a very good question. You know, now, as I say, in retrospect, I pick out a few things. I was telling somebody the other day, a small example. You know, where I grew up, it was like it's like a shanty town. I call it a shanty town with bricks. But and you know the kind of area, you know, depressed, poor area, and so on.
Mm.
So the kind of role models that you had there were, you know, the guy who can stab the fastest and all sorts of things like that.
Who had the most tattoos.
Yes, exactly. And who could win more playing dice and all sorts of things. Yeah. So there's this one thing. There was a neighbor, a guy who had a car.
Mm.
And, you know, his son was a friend of mine. I think we might have been 12 or 13 at the time. And so the son was able to, this guy would give the son the car to reverse out so that when he goes to work and so on. Mm. And I thought, yeah, you know, this is the one thing. Yeah. And then one time this guy, you know, he was not even living in our area. He used to come and visit.
Mm.
Then said, okay, you can, because he could see the envy in my eyes. Yeah.
Mm.
You must also try and I'll teach you how to drive.
Mm.
And I went to my mother to say, wow, yeah, this guy has offered to teach me to drive. And she's put me down. I don't even know if she smacked me or not. But she said, you are not going to go anywhere near that car or learn how to drive or whatever. Mm. And I thought, oh, this woman really hates me.
Mm.
You know, like,
yeah. This is my moment.
Yeah, and this is my moment. But it was that kind of thing. And she was right, because the next thing was going to be you drive the car and then you get to roll with those guys who are the mechanics and so on and so on. And then you drift away.
Yeah.
Which is what happened to some of my peers. Yeah.
Mm.
And so it was that ability to nurture you, because you're quite right. I mean, anyone who's grown up in the ghetto knows that there are two ways. You either make it big or you make it to prison or you die. I mean, there are two paths which are completely diametrically opposed.
Mm.
And for those of us who have made it through that kind of upbringing, then you just know how many misses you had, and it can only be because of the guidance you got from, you know, some neighbor or your parents or whatever. And some of it is just pure luck, quite frankly.
Mm. Let me ask you two questions, Dalia, and I want you just to divide them a little bit. 30 years was now the other day.
Yeah.
27th of April.
Mm.
Politically, you've been that animal. Graduating LLB 1993.
Mm. Mm.
So I want a question around that.
Mm.
Politically, 30 years, and judiciary, 30 years.
Mm.
The two would be different.
Yeah.
Answer those two questions for me, in essence of a reflection on the 30 years and then a reflection on the judiciary of 30 years.
Mm. Yeah, well, politically, of course, the 30 years has been, you know, an anticlimax in the sense that it has been a disappointment. You know, the excitement for those of us who actually were able to be part of the, you know, the dream come true, as it were, in the early 90s. I mean, I still remember specifically where I was when the announcement of the unbanning was made, and it was something that, you know, we never thought was ever going to happen.
Mm.
So from those great expectations, so to speak, to where we are now, it's really tragic. Mm. It's so tragic. It really is. Even just to watch the destruction of the ANC to what it is. I mean, this weekend I was, you know, when I was supposed to be laughing, I was more crying at the kind of, you know, what that organization has become. Yeah.
Mm.
So, and of course, what the country has become. I mean, if you go to some of the areas where we go to and we do our door-to-door campaigning or our rallies, mini rallies and so on, it's just... You almost cannot believe that actually we can have this kind of devastation.
And people will say that you're forced to say that, or you have to say that, because there's the aspect of opposition politics.
Yeah, no, but you see, that's the point. It's not that would be putting the cat before the horse, because the reason I'm in opposition is exactly because of that destruction of the country and organizational malaise. Yeah. If there wasn't that, I wouldn't be. I would still be, you know, where I was a few years ago. So I get it that people will think, yeah, look, it's election time, you have to criticize. No, that's not where I'm coming from. I'm just saying that 30-year journey, imagine the 30-year journey for someone like me who was there when the unbending, was there when the leaders were released, was there, you know, when we literally started the semblance of what you can call an ANC office. I left, I had just qualified as an attorney, and I left that to go and work full-time for the ANC. That's how, you know, passionate I was about, you know, rebuilding and making sure that we're getting ready and so on, the negotiations, CODESA, this, that, and the other. So that's where I'm coming from. From that to where we are now is quite a climb down. But as far as the judiciary is concerned, obviously, then that also, I have a unique take because in the 80s, I was part of a law firm that was doing human rights work, you know, representing detainees. Well, I was a detainee myself and representing detainees and MK soldiers and that kind of person. So I had a clear insight into the judiciary that was geared towards making sure that, you know, anything to do with the struggle was going to be destroyed. And even one of the worst parts was the fact that the clients, the hostility from the clients to the judiciary. I mean, many of our guys would say, look, you'd give them legal advice, and then after you've given them this long thing, they tell you, look, I'm not going to participate in an apartheid court. And then, then you have to negotiate that stance with making sure that he doesn't get the worst form of sentence.
Doesn't get punished for having just said that.
Exactly. In fact, I'm reminded of a story that was told by former church president Ngwepe when he was launching his book recently, where he was representing a guy, I think from the PAC, and he said, so this guy, he was trying to say why he mustn't get the death sentence and what have you. And then he says, when he finished, the guy just stood up and told the judge that, look, given half a chance, I'll kill all the white people and what. And then he said, oh, what the hell, you know. Yeah. So you had to be very careful with that. So coming from that hostile bench where you knew the outcome. I mean, you just did the best you can, but there's no way that some guy who's been found with 100 grenades is going to be to where we are now. Again, it's the dashed hopes where we thought, okay, now we're free, we're going to have a judiciary that's transformed and so on, but lo and behold, I think we're very, very, very far from that. I mean, the dream of a transformed judiciary and a progressive judiciary, which means one that is enlightened in the broadest sense of the word, is, if you ask me, very elusive at the moment. And you'll find that in the EFF manifesto, for example, we talk about the transformation of the JSC. As you know, I was once a spokesperson for that body. And one of the things we talk about is what we call qualitative transformation. So the Constitution talks, for example, about race and gender in Section 174. And our belief is that it should go far, far, far beyond that. Yeah.
So there's point one and two there.
Yeah.
Specifically, I think 1742.
Yes, it's 1742 that talks about race and gender. And even when I was in the JSC, I was always on this issue that's a narrow way. And that's from experience because, I mean, from practical experience, the fact that somebody is black, has a black skin, or is a a woman does not automatically translate into them having a progressive ideological outlook, for example, or, you know, a more accommodating approach, even for a woman judge, to even to women practitioners or women clients or women accused persons, or gender issues in broadly. That is not like a zero sum game. So, in my view, you need to transform the mindset more than the color or the gender. But those things are important, obviously, demographics and so on. But it's not sufficient at all in my experience.
Then when one looks at the number, let's just take for example the Constitutional Court. So the JSC does what it needs to do, and there's that whole aspect of looking at the transformation and the woman and in line with the Constitution.
Yeah.
And then at some point, you were interviewed, and they're done in public, which gives the transparency aspect.
Sure.
And then you spoke to this very concept that you're talking about now, experience, the kind of judgments that they have made or given, the acting stints in the Constitutional Court that's helpful, the pedigree, the suitability, the number of years.
Yeah.
But then, and then you referred to, of course, the issue spelled out in the Constitution, 174, race and gender. How do you inculcate? How do you manufacture? How do you get what you're talking about?
Yeah.
If that's the element that's lacking, and you can maybe argue that the numbers are there, someone might argue and say there's not one male, white male, individual on the on the Constitutional Court, for example, and make an argument out of that, and that's not the argument.
No.
But then, how do you get to the criteria you're talking about? How do you find that particular that element? How do you get to it?
Well, look, it starts. I suppose it starts even beyond university. We need public education. You know, you and I have a bit of a background in public broadcasting. You more than me, but you see, that for me, really, what attracted me to public broadcasting was exactly that element of public education, like serious focus on what you'll remember the slogan of citizen empowerment. So that's where you start. So if you are going to deal with mindsets, and then of course you go to the schooling system, then the university system, and so on. So it must start quite early. Community service. I'm a big proponent of community service for professionals, whether you're a doctor or a lawyer or whatever. I think between university and practicing your craft, you need to just go out there in the field, and you just get thrown into some rural area, and you must help people there to apply for the IDs and what have you, and grants and so on, so that you actually have a keen understanding of how poor people live in this country and what are the problems that need to be resolved. Because those things you're not going to get from some textbook. You know, you're going to get them by... You can't teach someone what it's like to live in an area where you can't have transport just to go to the... to get an ID. And you and I, you know, live here, you can just go to the Home Affairs down the road and so on. But think of someone who actually lives in an area where the whole idea of even getting to anywhere Home Affairs is a whole, like a month, has to plan for a whole month. And then they go there and they're told, no, the queue is too long, or the people have gone to lunch or whatever. And then they have to go back and start that thing again and so on. So if you're not aware of all those, so what am I saying? Training. Training, but not training as in a blackboard and and chalk. Yeah. Training, experiential training, and really getting to understand the country, the pulse of the country. So that's how you create individuals who are then going to use their degrees to complement that formal education with, as I say, an ideological outlook that is pro-poor almost automatically. So, for example, if you're sitting as a judge up there, you know, wearing those big robes, you're not going to then, if you have a person like that appearing before you, you're not going to say, oh, well, just because there's some piece of paper that's missing, the case is going to be postponed or whatever, which is the right thing to do. But if you are not sensitive to that, this person actually probably took months to even be in front of you in that courtroom, then you won't say, okay, we'll stop at 4. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You'll be able to say, no, look, maybe we can go on for another 2 hours so that we finish this case. And just that is that is
understanding that, that for that person, just time alone beyond it's the issue.
Like, yeah, for you, it's just grabbing an Uber or whatever. But for them, it's a whole struggle.
Yeah.
So it's that I'm looking for. For me, in the if we're talking about the transformed judiciary, it's that kind of thing. Not the that you are, it's because you are a male, so what, or a female, and so on. Alone, it's really quite meaningless.
Dali, you've touched on a really really important aspect, which is the cost and the experience in that particular space of the judiciary. I'm going to park the experience in that particular space and what people experience there.
Right.
Let's just talk about the costs in essence. At the Marikana hearing, for example,
right.
You stopped and you made a particular application and you refused pro bono.
Yeah.
So when the headline came, said Dali Mpofu refuses pro bono, it struck a chord with individuals who maybe needed to have a go at you. Dali Mpofu is about the money, and Dali Mpofu wants to be paid.
Yeah.
And Dali Mpofu wants to be paid well here by the state. The whole issue of that pro bono element, correct me if I'm wrong, was to actually to get the state to play for innocent victims who needed justice.
Absolutely.
And needed justice by virtue of finding someone like you instead of going to, I don't want to say
aid.
A legal aid in essence. What the argument there was that a lot of people miss, and I hope I'm right, is that you wanted to represent them, but for them to be represented by yourself fairly for justice, somebody needed to pay for that, and the state needed to pay for that, in essence.
Yeah. No, it was all, it actually had nothing to do with me. I'll let me explain. You see, in that case, funny enough, actually that case was not even instigated by me. It was instigated by the workers themselves. And I'll explain what they were saying, which made sense, So that case, by the way, is probably, if there was any exercise in self-impoverishment, it was that case, Because that case started, I think, in October or September of 2012, a month or so after the massacre. And went on for the rest of 2012, 2013. We were not getting paid 1 cent. So just picture this. If you can find anyone in the country who can do this, then I'll be very happy to meet them. Of working almost for like 14 months or so, firstly in Rustenburg, where every day you have to drive there. If you don't drive there, you must stay in a hotel. And then you don't get paid at all. In other words, I was the one who was subsidizing the state. Because you are paying in. My office is locked up in Joburg. I have to pay rent for that office, and I'm not doing any other case yet. But it's something I had to do for those workers, because otherwise they wouldn't have representation. Now picture on the other side, the police, the ones who had killed these people, have a team of they had like two or three senior counsels, six juniors, like a whole team of seven people there. And the company loan me had another team of four or five people. By the time, at some stage, I was literally alone because people, even the people who were prepared to assist me, just couldn't, I couldn't keep them. I mean, I couldn't even blame them. They started falling off one by one. So you have this complete, they call it in law, inequality of arms. Yeah. So these people can spread the work among themselves, and I have to literally spread it among myself only. Yeah. Okay. So that was the thing. So the workers at some stage said, no, this is absolute nonsense, which was true. Why can't we have a team with or at least half of what the police are having, which is also getting, these people are getting paid every day we're here. They are getting paid hundreds of thousands of rand among the those teams. And we have to make do with scraps. Yeah. So they said, no, we're not going to go to this commission until our lawyers are also paid. And that's where the story started. And then the first applicant in that application was a guy called Mzokolo Magidiwana. So it's reported in the law cases as Magidiwana versus the state.
I use that particular example, Dali, to maybe get to this point.
Yeah.
For me to have you represent me, I have to have an understanding of where I'm going to get the money from.
Yeah.
For me to have you represent me, I have to have an understanding of where I'm going to get the money from.
Yeah.
And the law and the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and every other aspect we talk about is equality before the law and whatever. And the point I make then is that financially you are out of reach.
Yeah.
And you become out of reach because of your expertise that you have gained.
Yes.
Right. The expertise. The expertise that those people in those cases need.
Yeah.
With the irony that you're unavailable because of cost.
Mm.
And so we throw them then at these legal aid and whatever it is. Isn't that the worst irony, in essence, of the judicial system?
Yeah.
Is that me, to be represented, need to run to legal aid because I cannot get the Dali and Porfu.
Absolutely.
Because of the cost.
Absolutely.
And it's, let me add this rider, Dali, because I want you to add to answer it in full without asking another question.
Right.
The potential of me getting the result I want legal aid might not be the result I want based on the expertise of that individual. Whereas if I had you, how then is justice then applied where I don't get the result that I need?
No, it's absolutely right. There's no such thing as justice in an unequal society, particularly one as unequal as ours. There is just zero, justice. And I'm talking not just about justice in the court's way. The whole thing is an injustice. Inequality is at the root. You can't have justice without equality. And, you know, it's an equation that most people miss. So you're quite right. So in a system like this, and in any capitalist society anyway, the dice is loaded against the poor. I mean, you can't win. You can't beat the system. I think I've made this example before. So if you want, if you do something to me and I want to take you to court, ultimately, I'm going to win because I'm richer, and you, as you say, you can probably, either you have to speak for yourself or find someone who's like a second year apprentice, so to speak. So the system is totally unjust. I mean, what I do, the reason I work so hard is because I was telling some pupils today, yeah. So my practice is structured like this. I have to have like one case that's going to pay for all the freebies that I do. Mm. So 80% of the work I do is for nothing.
Mm.
But then there must be one case that's going that's to subsidize those cases, yeah, so that I can pay for my rent and my office space and all that jazz, yeah.
Mm.
So, and not everyone can do that because it means you almost have to work two or three times the amount of work that you would actually do. And ironically, some of the most complex cases are those ones that you don't do for money. And they're the most demanding. But also, professionally, you can then say, okay, well, I'm just going to prioritize my paying case. Yeah, Denzel and his problem must go to the back of the queue.
Mm.
No. You have to apply yourself almost equally and sometimes even more for those people who don't have, yeah.
Mm.
But the point is that if one or two or five or 10 people do that, it's a drop in the ocean.
Yeah.
It really makes a difference to only because you can't do as much as you should do.
Mm.
So that's why we have to fight to transform the system itself.
Mm.
So that it's not this one or that one or Moses Kakane or Galwana or whatever. And because those people also get consumed by other work or become unavailable and that kind of thing. So it has to be the entire system must be overhauled and changed so that it does the things I'm talking to you about.
Yeah.
Now imagine we can have like 10, 20 students going to help people in some poor area. But imagine if you actually had a system that prescribes that when you finish your degree, you're going to go and help some communities. So all of a sudden you have 10,000 people helping 10,000 communities. So that's a completely different ballgame than some, it's not like some charity thing which you do on a Saturday or whatever. It becomes...
And by choice, it
becomes part of the system. And if we did that with lawyers, we did that with doctors.
Would you be open to that?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, you're arguing for it. Would you be open to that?
Not only open, I think it is essential. I mean, if we have an EFF government, that is what the kind of thing we will do tomorrow.
Mm.
Because the levels of problems, Denzel, it's unthinkable that you can think you can do it like one piecemeal here, somebody goes to see a lawyer here or whatever.
Mm.
The whole thing just needs to be changed completely so that you give access to services to the people. And literally you are able to reach every community. It won't be ideal. You won't give them a Rolls Royce service or whatever. But at least those people must have. Yeah.
Dali, I'm going to take some calls. I'm going to ask you to put the headphones on. I've got a million questions for you, but of course, our callers are wanting to ask certain questions as well. Mandla in Pretoria. Mandla?
Yes, how are you?
I'm good, Mandla. How are you, Chief?
I'm good. To the People's Advocate, Mpofu SC, good evening.
Good evening, Mandla.
Yes, Denzel, we are sitting with the son of the soil in your studio today. And I guess a lot of people, in particular those who are so-called custodial lawyers on Twitter, were jealous of the achievement of the son of the soil. They might have other ideas, but for me it's more of a human rights lawyer, and who cares for the people. I mean, as he said with Marikana, he faced so many SC, senior car council, alone. And in the recent time, he has dealt with the so-called the judiciary in this country. And he has collapsed it, in my own opinion. In fact, that constitutional court has collapsed completely because of the laws which they were particular designed for those who they hate most, when the establishment and the so-called media pushes some narrative, and indeed One judge in the Western Cape High Court, you know, he was telling us, you know, as a public layman, to say that he was reading an article, you know, so he believes that journalist more than anything else. Worse with Kampembe, when he said there's an extraordinary a case against Nxamalala, you know, on that contempt of court, which was indeed injustice. You know.
Mandla, I'm going to leave it there. Mandla, I think Dali Mpofu has taken the sort of you know, credit for what he has done there. Thato in Florida, Thato.
Good evening, Paddy.
Sure, Thato. I'm good, man.
And to the advocate. Listen, I have an issue. My company had rendered services to the SAPS. I think I've been in court since 2016. I'm stuck for non-payment. I've been pursuing payment since then. They've rented my equipment, and I was only asked to go and fetch my equipment in 2020. And when I went there to collect my equipment that they were renting, which was like in 6 police stations, I couldn't find most of my equipment. It was damaged and blah. So I've been pursuing the payment for damages of my equipment. I took the matter to court. It's dragging because of I don't have money to actually, I've been trying to pay every month. It's been since 2016. I'm just trying to get that amount. My company is completely shut down. Like, I'm not operating anymore.
Dato in Florida. Let's go to Godfrey in Cape Town. Godfrey?
Good evening, Denzel, and the advocate.
Sure, man.
Hi, Godfrey.
My name is Godfrey from Cape Town. I'm calling as a blind person. I've got an issue with SA Home Loans or bank or insurance. During 2019, I bought a house. And the house, 8 months down the line, the house burnt. It was a four-bedroom house. The house burnt. It was during COVID time. The insurance or the bank, they shortchanged me. They didn't provide the services which the contract stipulates. Instead, you know what they did? They come with a small offer, and all of a sudden, the house was registered. I was given the deeds, everything, and they told me, no, they are no longer going to do any business with me. They are out. And I'm left with a big house here, which I don't know what to do, because now I'm struggling to fix my house. The insurance at the bank, they're gone away, and I didn't owe them anything.
Godfrey in Cape Town. Khotso in Midrand. Khotso.
Evening to you, Mr. Tenze.
Sure, Khotso, man.
And the popular advocate.
Sure, Khotso.
Look, man. Firstly, my question, Mr. Tenze, to Mr. Talumpov, Advocate Mpofu, is in regard with the interviews. The interviews which we are seeing lately, we highly welcome it. It's just unfortunately whereby the outcomes of the interview doesn't tally with what we are seeing as it happens. I can give a reference, a point in case and a reference about the outcome of the interview of the Chief Justice. Who's the Chief Justice currently as you're speaking today? Because according to reports, the outcome were not what we are seeing, we are getting here. Then the second example which I want to give, it is in regard with there's a JP in KwaZulu Natal. I think he knows she's a female. That JP as we're speaking today, she also emerged despite there were some serious doubts about her judgment, whereby there are some judgments which she had, whereby she acquitted the person who murdered. Point-blank
matter. Khotso, I'm gonna leave it there. Khotso, you think you're using an example there. Dali Mpofu might or might not be able to reflect on it. Dali, the issue with bringing you into studio is people see your work and people will comment on your work And people, as you pointed out, the justice system, people will want to ask you a million questions because they have legal problems their entire life. Whether it's owing PEP stores and they've got a legal letter, or whether it is a house that's burnt down and insurance, people will try and find something because it costs. How do you answer, you know, those particular questions?
Yeah, look, Denzel, it's totally depressing because, I mean, I could sit here for the whole week answering those questions, but as
and,
I say...
And if I showed you my, my screen here, Dali and Pofu, it is people just want to ask, and I mean, I know. You know, we have time.
But that just... makes the point that I was making, which is that the problems are so deep-seated. You can imagine, they're probably, for every caller who asks me about this or that problem, there's a million other people who don't even have airtime to make that call. So, and that's what we mean when we talk about fundamental change. You know, people all often ask me, you know, how do you balance your the legal work and the political work. And I said, it's because I don't see any difference. Because for me, it's about justice. If to do justice, you can't do it case by case, you know, house by house and so on. You need to overhaul the entire thing. So, you know, the Tato talks about a case that's been going on since 2016. Yeah, that's about 10 years. You can just think about that. Yeah.
And he says he's making payments.
Yeah, he's making payments. He's and now he can make payments and so on. So it's a deep-seated issue. So what I would say to him is, well, that also goes for Godfrey. So there are some lawyers who are prepared, attorneys who are prepared to do cases like that on what is called a contingency basis. And that means, for example, in the case of Godfrey, fighting against an insurance company. The, you know, I mean, just think about it. Godfrey has to face an insurance company, giant company. When it goes to court, they'll probably bring four or five
and the
senior
banks.
Counsel and the banks. I mean, what chances does he have in this current system? But anyway, there are people who are prepared to do what I call contingency work, which is some form of you know, they do the work and then they charge you a percentage or whatever. We as advocates were not allowed to do to charge you a percentage, but the attorneys can do it. So they must really look around for people like that in Cape Town, I think, in the case of Godfrey, you know. But, yeah, as you say, it's really is the most frustrating thing, and one cannot do it piecemeal, one case at a time. Khotso's issue about the interviews, well, unfortunately, I'm no longer the spokesperson of the JSC, but I can say this, that the reason why those interviews are done in the public domain and they are broadcast live and all that is exactly for people to be a part of those interviews and make their own comments and their own observations. And it's an important system because the I think the commissioners themselves who ask the questions, they are aware that the public is weighing in because the public, after all, the judges are there to serve the public. So, yeah, while I might not be able to comment on specific cases, it's true that and that was my role when I was the spokesperson of the JSC, that after every set of interviews, you go out there, do an interview, and explain to the people that, you know, there were 10 vacancies, we couldn't fill this because we couldn't find.
And you hope that in your selection process you've instilled those characteristics that you spoke about in
absolutely.
The beginning.
Yes, because they can see the questioning.
Exactly.
So people would, and it's a good system in that sense because at that time, people would literally stop you in a supermarket and say, oh, that I like the question you asked about this and the other and so on, because it affected me, you know, like the example I was making about stopping a case at a particular time. So the system is supposed to be like that, and it's also flawed in a way. The other reason why you have MPs, for example, sitting in the in those interviews is exactly because those are elected representatives. So presumably, when they ask questions, they are asking for the broader public. So there are attempts to make it broad and representative, but ultimately, it's still an elitist. So I mean, there are many serious communities that are not represented in the thing at
all. Let me take Amos, Dali. Amos in Mamelodi. Amos?
Evening, Dazel and the People's Advocate.
Sure, Amos.
Hi, Amos.
I need to find that because most of the cases against government, Mr. Dali, you were not winning. It looked like now everybody was looking to say, you know what, when you go against Ramaphosa, he can't win. When you go against the state, he can't win. As you said, the system is structured, it looked like it is structured to oppose those people who doesn't have power. And you find that all these people that we're against with, all the cases, like Mr. Blackie, we're busy with Mrs. Mukwabane's case, you end up like exchanging verbal fighting on that. Now, I want to find that if you said it's structured, that thing, you mean the court, you can't win the court against the state, as you are saying.
Amos and Mamelodi. Dalian Pofu, let me add to that.
Sure.
I think he's also leaning on what people would talk about your style.
Yeah.
And I think you've created your own style of representation.
Yes.
And some people would say it's aggressive, and some people would say it's intimidating. Is it? Just added to Amos's as component.
No, it's not. I mean, I've practiced law for more than 30 years, and I think that's the problem. I suppose it's a problem with this TV thing here. So you'll have the one case or one incident, and then the whole 5 years you have to be dealing with what that, after you've you've had like hundreds and hundreds of other incident-free cases.
Yeah,
that's fine. I mean, that's it's part of the deal. Yeah, no, but no, I'm not aggressive. I'm in fact, somebody was saying to me the other day, look, I'd have known you for so long, but you know, when sometimes when I'm in court, I try to tell people, no, he's not like that. He's a nice guy. So I say, I'm always a nice guy. It's not like it changes. Yeah. Yeah. But having said that, you know, the courtroom is, ours is what is called an adversarial system. Which, really is a system where the truth is tested with cross-examination and all sorts of things like that, which by their nature are like that. You've heard, if you think I'm aggressive, you should have seen people like Bezos and so on in some of the really hot,
and I've watched him
hot cases. Yeah,
in Marikana he was brilliant.
Absolutely. Yeah. And but before that, before there was TV in the courtrooms, I mean, I had the privilege of being in courtrooms with him since the mid '80s, from the Delmas trial to all sorts of other difficult cases. Yeah. So now, if in those days, I mean, if you are representing someone who's facing the death sentence, you know, it's not your job to be hugging and kissing everyone there.
Yeah.
It's to make sure that the person gets full representation. And you can imagine what it was like under apartheid, where the judge already thinks that this terrorist must be killed like tomorrow. Yeah. I don't even know why we even have a trial for them. Yeah. So the people like George had to fight that kind of system, of course within the rules. But you know, if it was not for a Sunday picnic. So there are moments, as in any profession, where you have to put your foot down, and you only do it, you know, when you feel it. For me, the biggest, the line I draw is a complete injustice. Yeah. So if I feel that an injustice is being done to particularly to the client or generally, then you can be sure that I'm going to fight back.
Sure. Stembiso is gone. I was wanting to take Stembiso down into Durban. It's gone. But let me ask you a question then, based on the NPA.
Yeah. Maybe, sorry, Tenzel.
Sure.
Just to answer Amos's specific question, yeah.
Oh, but, sorry, yes.
But the system being rigged, the system is rigged. You know what I mean? So it's rigged against the poor. It's rigged against those people who are not, you know, the favorites of the media. It's rigged. It's so rigged that you don't even want to know. I mean, there's a case that I'm involved with now, and you see the chorus of media commentary, which is obviously intended to sway the judges in one way or the other, and so on. And there's literally nothing you can do. In another instance, you have all these NGOs that are the, you know, and then there are no other NGOs that give you the counter narrative, so to speak. Yeah. Because those other ones are funded by I don't know who and that kind of thing. So the entire thing is just completely rigged against the underdog. And that's why sometimes you really have to, I mean, I'll give an example. You talk about what you would think is aggression. Yeah. Now, picture this. You're sitting in a hearing in Parliament representing Busisiwe Mkhwebane. There are 36 members of that committee. 25 of them, or whatever, are from the DA and the ANC, and they already know what they want. You're there alone. Yeah. So if you're going to play the nice game, you're going to be liquidated in 2 minutes.
Because they've already decided.
They're
not there to hear your point.
No, they're not interested in your point. Yeah. So if the whole thing can be literally done in 2 days, and you're, as I say, completely obliterated. So you have to find ways of making sure that these people are going to listen, and they're going to follow their own rules, by the way, and you know, and go through the proper process. And that's not done by hugs and kisses. Yeah, it's done by having a formidable strategy of making sure that you're going to be listened to, and that's what happens.
Dalian Pofu, in a minute, Stembiso was there and she's gone again. But in a minute, it's 10 o'clock. Do you need for you to be at your best? Do you need the NPA to be able to do their work? Is it functional because of the other? And if you do not have the NPA doing their work, the judiciary and your space becomes 100%. A farce in essence.
100%. I mean, if you look at, again, the approach we've taken in the EFF manifesto is to look at what we call the ecosystem. And, you know, if there's one compliment, just so that you see that I'm not just criticizing everything. One of the best things that the current government has done is to do this thing called clusters. So you have the JCPS cluster, which is the JCPS, I think, stands for Justice, Crime Prevention and Security. So you have that cluster of departments. And that's an approach which, if you have an EFF government tomorrow, we might reconfigure those clusters. But the cluster system itself is brilliant because it talks to what you are saying, because you can't just fix the judiciary, you can't just fix the NPA, you can't just fix the police, you can't just fix, you know, the social services of the people who counsel victims of GBV and child abuse and so on. It should be seen as one thing, because, you know, like you say, even the NPA, by the way, The NPA depends on the police. If the police are not investigating properly or taking bribes and all sorts of things, then the NPA is going to be seen as dysfunctional. And yes, if the NPA is also as corrupt and has got selective eyes, they prosecute this one but not this one and so on, then by the time the thing gets to the judiciary, it's all distorted anyway. And then if the judiciary has the deficiencies that we've spoken about. So if you are a minister of justice, as I've been accused of to aspire to be in within a few weeks, then you have to literally look at that ecosystem and be able to cooperate, as you say, with the Minister of Police, the Minister of Social Development, and so on. Because you can't resolve, I mean, like the drug problem. The drug problem, yes, it's a policing issue. You do a drug bust, whatever you. But surely that problem goes much deeper. It's a social problem.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So, yes, it's looking at the entire ecosystem. You can't simply say it's the NPA, it's the police,
gotcha,
it's the court, it's this one, it's the lawyers or whatever. It has to be comprehensive. And at the root of society, not, you know, it's this thing of blitzkrieg and roadblocks and what have you, it's fine. It has its place, yeah. But if you don't go to the fundamentals of what causes a dysfunctional society and an unequal society, because in an unequal society, crime is going to fester.
Gotcha.
Dali, whatever you do.
I have to end it there. It is past 10 o'clock. That's how an hour goes. And super, the myriad of calls calling everybody else. Dali Mpofu, it's always a pleasure to have you.
Yeah.
And seeing the calls and seeing the issues and whatever, I have to bring you back.
No, absolutely.
And this is a conversation that needs just to be engaged over.
Yes.
And I think the next time we bring you back over 2 hours.
No, absolutely. And I always enjoy it because you prepare so much. And thanks for your preparation, even went to getting my mother's name.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.